In July 1978, U.S. Senators Wendell Anderson and Muriel Humphrey of Minnesota and three other senators took the vice president's private jet on its first ever trip to the North Woods. For years, environmentalists and local residents had been arguing over whether the Boundary Waters Canoe Area of northeastern Minnesota needed more stringent federal regulations. As the debate reached a fevered pitch, these elected officials came to see what the fuss was for. During the senators' two-day visit, they toured Boundary Waters Lakes and listened to presentations from both sides of the issue. A bill reforming BWCA management had just passed through the U.S. Congress. As involved parties awaited the Senate's vote, both sides knew this trip could have a direct effect on the bill's final outcome. When Anderson, Humphrey, and others traveled to Seagull Resort at the end of the Gunflint Trail for a fish fry lunch, resort owner Lois Danielson served dinner on placemats which showed an alligator representing the federal government eating the Boundary Waters. Lee Nelson Zoff, who owned Jocko's Clearwater Lodge on the Gunflint Trail, remembers the day well.
It was a wonderful fish fry, and a lot of people from town and the other resorts, people were there, of course.
After the dinner, Lois Danielson stood within earshot of the senators.
They were standing on the dock, and she overheard one of them say, "Well, that was a wonderful dinner, but it's not going to change my mind." She said, "I should have pushed them over the dock." So, you know, it was, I think the senators had their minds made up and we had ours made up.
Each year, some 200,000 visitors journey through the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, located within the Superior National Forest. In many ways, this 1.1 million-acre, federally designated wilderness managed by the U.S. Forest Service seems untouched by the modern world. But local interests have continually clashed with environmental ideals ever since the state of Minnesota closed off a portion of the area to homesteading, mining, and logging in 1902. In the time leading up to the passage of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Act in 1978, tensions finally boiled over. By that time, the Boundary Waters argument was more than 50 years old. Kevin Preschult is a former executive director of Friends of the Boundary Waters, a nonprofit based in Minneapolis which works to protect the environmental interests of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness.
The first administrative protections of the area as a wilderness go back to 1926, when the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture declared about 640,000 acres, or 1,000 square miles, of what's now the Boundary Waters as an administrative wilderness. But those guidelines for managing the area were never that clear, and there were exceptions. As the rest of the country developed more of wilderness policies through the 30s and 40s and 50s, the Boundary Waters was always sort of in a special category because of the history of uses not normally considered permitted in a wilderness area, such as you know, some logging, some motorboat use, and things like that.
Bills like the 1948 Ty-Blatnick Act tightened regulations on the area, and Minnesota Senator Hubert Humphrey included the Boundary Waters in the National Wilderness Preservation System as part of the 1964 Wilderness Act. The National Wilderness Preservation System is made up of federally owned and managed lands of at least 5,000 acres which have minimal human influence. Earl Niewald served as ranger of the Gunflint District of the Superior National Forest from 1971 through 1980.
The trouble we had in 1978, or trouble or whatever, was really as a result from the way the Wilderness Act was drawn up. Senator Humphrey was a proponent of the Wilderness Act, and he wanted the BWCA in the wilderness. But he knew politically that was a problem, so he put in several exemptions of timber cutting, snowmobile use, motors, and so forth. It was the only wilderness in the United States that had these exemptions. So, you know, it was inevitable that this would be challenged because the pure wilderness people were very unhappy with those exceptions.
After passage of the 1964 Wilderness Act, environmental groups pressed several lawsuits against the U.S. Forest Service regarding mining and logging inside the boundary waters. Kevin Preschult.
So, a lot of that litigation and the controversy around those issues stemmed from this sort of unclear status of the boundary waters. You know, was it a wilderness or not? And those controversies sort of led to then a return of the issue to Congress really starting in late 74 and then into 1975 and onward over the future of the boundary waters and whether it is a wilderness or not, whether logging should be permitted or not, whether motorboats and snowmobiles should be allowed inside the area or not. And that's what sort of touched off the congressional controversy then in the mid-1970s.
In October 1975, Minnesota's 8th District Congressman Jim Oberstar introduced a bill he hoped would end the controversy. Former Ranger Earl Niewald.
Oberstar decided that by changing the law, he could get things, maybe straighten things out. So what he proposed was to take about 400,000 acres of boundary waters and put it into a national recreation area. And this would be less laws and be more open, and hopefully that would take care of things, and there would timber sales could continue. Well, this is kind of like waving a red flag in front of a bull, you know. When he proposed this, and the wilderness proponents really came forth with that.
Environmentalists wanted all logging and motor use stopped in the BWCA. They worried that stands of Boundary Waters virgin white pine were destined for the lumberyard unless more regulations were adopted. They felt motor use in the area undermined the natural solitude and peace that visitors sought on their canoe trips. But many area residents resented the idea of removing opportunities to cut timber, fish by motorboat, or snowmobile in the area. Tourism drove the local economy, and business owners worried changes to Boundary Waters management would hurt them financially. Gunflint Trail business owner Ted Young.
And for those that think it had anything to do with economics, it might have a little bit to do with the economic well-being of people up here. It was mainly over the recreational opportunities of people up here. I can just imagine if you were on Lake Minnetonka and they told you you couldn't have your cabin cruiser and you couldn't have your powerboat anymore, what kind of uprising there would be. Or if you were in Minneapolis and said you had to walk to whatever the Symphony Hall is called there, or Northrop Auditorium, you had to walk everywhere because you couldn't use your cars anymore, there'd be an upward revolt. Well, this is basically telling the same thing to people up here.
Environmentalists worked with Congressman Don Fraser of Minneapolis and Bruce Vento of St. Paul to craft a bill to counter Oberstar's proposal to turn roughly half of the boundary waters into a national recreation area. The bill Fraser introduced to Congress in June 1976 proposed a slight expansion of the boundary waters canoe area, an end to logging and mining, and the removal of all motors. As Friends of the Boundary Waters rallied support around the country to save the boundary waters, many locals found the environmentalists' claim of ecological degradation in the boundary waters surprising. Dave Tuttle owned Bearskin Lodge on East Bearskin Lake, halfway up the Gunflint Trail.
Most everyone felt that the present legislation was working just fine. The users were happy. The resorts and the outfitters seemed to be satisfied with the way the boundary waters was being run. And environmentally, I thought everything was working out as well. So when these changes were being made, our main question was, why make all these changes and diddle with the running of the Boundary Waters when it seemed like it was working just fine?
The disagreement about Boundary Waters management grew into a battle of us versus them. On one side, people fought for the recreation and economic opportunities they'd historically enjoyed in the Boundary Waters. The other side argued that Boundary Waters needed recognition and preservation as a national natural resource. Gunflint Trail business owner Ted Young.
And I remember Oberstar had a meeting somewhere up here with a bunch of the resorts. And he explained what had happened at that meeting. And they just about went nuts. And he was saying, this is an awful bill that Bruce Vento and Don Fraser are proposing.
Both sides needed to broadcast their side of the Boundary Waters debate, not only to their local constituents, but across the entire country. Locals opposed to the changes saw how effectively Friends of the Boundary Waters organized for their cause. So in 1977, residents formed the Boundary Waters Conservation Alliance to represent their interests. Both the Friends and the Alliance traveled to Washington, D.C. to lobby for their viewpoint. To help advance their case, the Friends reached out for assistance from nationally recognized environmental groups. Former Friends Executive Director Kevin Preschult.
And then there were a number of organizations that participated and provided leadership and assistance as well. Groups like the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, the Isaac Walton League of America, MPIRG, and other groups like that. And many of those environmental groups not only had Minnesota members and staff, but had national staff and national members as well. And we relied heavily on people like Brock Evans from the Sierra Club, who ran the Sierra Club's Washington, D.C. office and was a very experienced Washington hand in terms of knowing how the legislative process worked and how to sort of train young green recruits on how to lobby and how to make the visits to the offices and how to get our messages across.
It was the first time most local residents had been involved with politics on a national level. Gunflint Lodge owner Bruce Kerfoot chaired the local division of the Boundary Waters Conservation Alliance.
We can fuss and argue with the Friends of the Boundary Waters because we're Minnesotans and we've all got a venue which we can plead our case and wave our flag and argue against each other. But when you start taking the National Sierra on or the National Audubon or the Ikes, holy smokes, you can't even get to talk to those people. And the closest you ever get is what happens in a hearing in Washington. And even that's more of a dog and pony show than it is reality.
Many local residents distrusted the implications of the Fraser bill. Clearwater Lodge owner Lee Zoff.
And part of the bill was those resorts that were riparian to the Boundary Waters could offer their resort property to the government. And then any other property on that lake, the government would have the right of first refusal when they came up for sale. So with that being in there, it was just like, oh, they're going to take over everything, kick us all out. You know, we had that mentality for quite a while.
Former Ranger Earl Niewald.
But anyway, it came to us to a point where boiling over point, and this was a reflection, really reflected in Grand Marais and other towns at the Boundary Waters. The local people, of course, who made their livelihood in the Boundary Waters by resorts are the ones that enjoyed snowmobiling, fishing, and so forth, were very, very opposed to this bill.
Gunflint business owner Ted Young.
We had this meeting, and it was decided to have this big protest in Grand Marais. In the meantime, Howard Joins got every store, and I mean every store and business in Grand Marais, to close. And when they went to assemble, We had 1,000 people with logging trucks and skidders and marched from the point there, the Coast Guard point, to the Forest Service. And a pickup truck was set up as a platform for speakers to speak. And I remember the most notable speaker was Rich Humphrey, the mayor of Grand Marais. And he said, now, I remember his words, I have always been told that you have to have power to get anything done. And I'm here to tell you, with all you people here, we've got the power. And he pointed to the Forest Service, and then he said, they no longer have any power. And the city actually cut the wire, or took down the wire, the electrical wire from their office, disconnected it, and they went black.
While locals protested, the environmental side worked steadily to advocate their viewpoint to concerned citizens. Kevin Preschult of Friends of the Boundary Waters.
People knew that the Boundary Waters was this incredible area, that it should be protected more completely as a wilderness in management and not just in name, and that it had this incredible natural beauty and ecological values and recreational values as a wilderness that, you know, are found really nowhere else in the United States.
The Boundary Waters controversy frequented the pages of Duluth and Minneapolis newspapers. Ranger Earl Niewald reads headlines that his staff collected into a scrapbook.
God's Country Controversy, Battle Lines Drawn Over BWCA. BWCA plan will bring Forest Service enemies. Boundary Waters feeling run deep. BWCA begins its season of uncertainty. Law's interpretation leaves no one happy. BWCA law confuses resorters and enforcers. Towns oppose BWCA plan. Clubs protest BWCA plan. Loggers foresee harm in BWCA plans. BWCA controversy grows.
Public hearings about the bills were held both in Minnesota and Washington, but the more the issue was discussed, the less likely a compromise seemed. From 1972 to 1982, Jim Cherry served as director of Wilderness Canoe Base on Seagull Lake near the end of the Gunflint Trail.
Well, one of the problems was that, on the one hand, there were some that would label themselves as conservationists who wanted to put a padlock on it and leave it strictly wild, and the best management would, in effect, be almost no management at all. And that represented the one kind of extreme. The other extreme was found in those who failed to see that this is a national resource and treasure that belongs to all of the people. And it's not just something that I can lay claim to in my own backyard as being mine to do with it as I please.
By April 1978, environmentalists successfully argued to Congress that eliminating logging inside the Boundary Waters would have no noticeable effect on Minnesota's logging industry. But legislators were less interested in hearing arguments about motor use in the Boundary Waters, since there was little proof that motorboats and snowmobiles caused notable damage. Gunflint Lodge owner Bruce Kerfoot.
It became social value rather than in a resource value. Because in resources, we made a strong enough case that they had nothing to fight for because we didn't have abuses or degradation. But when it gets to social values, now you're just talking a philosophy. Social value is I can hear somebody in a distance. That's not acceptable to me. Particularly if they're singing Kumbaya and they're a Boy Scout troop, because that destroys my values of the wilderness. Well, now how do you argue that one? Because that's perhaps legitimate in their eyes. It may not be legitimate to the majority of the users or what needs to be accomplished, but they have a position from which to argue. And that one was a tough skirmishing act.
In June 1978, an environmentalist-supported bill passed the U.S. Congress. Still, the local side refused to give an inch. It seemed impossible to draft a bill that would please all involved parties. So after the Senate Parks and Recreation Subcommittee toured the Boundary Waters that July, the senators decided to end the controversy once and for all with a negotiated compromise between the two sides. Later that month, negotiations began in Washington, D.C. Bruce Kerfoot.
Those days were real tough because it was closed doors and they'd come out and whisper to us and we'd say, no, we can't live with that. No, we can do this.
When the negotiating ended after nearly 3.5 days, both sides walked away feeling jilted. Former Friends Executive Director Kevin Preschult.
Many of us, and me included, felt that there were too many compromises and that in this final negotiation and that it went too far, particularly on motor use within the wilderness. But I think at the same time we understood that it was important to get most of what we wanted, or even if it was imperfect, and that there was a lot of good for the wilderness in that final bill.
The compromise bill passed both the Senate and House, and on October 21, 1978, President Jimmy Carter signed the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness Act into law. With the new law, the Boundary Waters became officially known as the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. The act added 50,000 acres of land to the area and eliminated logging, mining, and snowmobiling. The act also allowed motorboats with motor size limits on approximately 21% of the water in the wilderness, but called for a permit system to regulate this motor traffic. Forest Service officials like Earl Niewald found themselves facing the challenge of how to put the law's new requirements for Boundary Waters management into practice.
They had said, okay, here it is, and here's the law, you guys implement it. So that was a big job. I know there was probably that we worked on that a year or some did, and I think it worked out okay. But and a lot of the resort or the outfitters were very concerned about that. You know, they say, well, hey, you know, if you start putting these limits on us, what's it going to do? And then it was mostly a matter of uncertainty. You know, they didn't know what was going to come up, so they were very, very concerned.
Some local businesses did disappear as a result of the 1978 Act. 6 Gunflint Trail businesses sold to the federal government through a provision in the bill. Other Gunflint Trail business owners adapted to the changes, and many began emphasizing canoe outfitting. While discussions about the bill can still spark bitter feelings 35 years after the bill's passage, the local tourist industry remains strong and self-sustaining. All year long, the area attracts visitors who canoe, boat, hike, ski, and snowshoe through the Boundary Waters and the surrounding forest. Gunflint Trail business owner Ted Young.
The best thing that could happen, say, especially for the outsiders and to a lesser extent, but to some extent, to the resorts, really, was you get a big area, you put a ring around it, you make it real special, you make entry, restrict entry by permits, and then those with economic self-interest would really make a way to get the permits as easy as they can, so they can get permits. Doesn't matter cost or anything. It's the best thing that could have ever happened to them.
As a resource valued by a wide population for numerous and sometimes conflicting reasons, the Boundary Waters will never be completely free of controversy. Whether deciding if cell phone towers should be visible from within the Boundary Waters or determining the effects of mining on the area's natural resources, the debate over what makes wilderness wilderness never ends. Clearwater Lodge owner Lee Zoff.
It's still the main problem is people from other parts of the country that have this dream about what the wilderness should look like and what's practical for people that live there is always going to be a problem.
As its issues and advocates change, the Boundary Waters remains. Kevin Preschult of Friends.
I still feel it is this incredible resource, so a fabulous natural wilderness area. I still come back on trips every year. I've probably been on 150 or more trips to the Boundary Waters over the years, and I never get tired of visiting the area. It's still beautiful, it's wild, it's an incredible resource.
History Speaks is funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which supports arts, cultural, and history features on WTIP. This documentary was produced by Ada Igo, with assistance from Kelly Schoenfelder and narration by Rose Arrowsmith-Deku. Thank you.